Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning taking your calls. If you have questions from the Bible or about the Bible or about the Christian faith or Christian life, that's the kind of thing we discuss here for a half hour each morning. And you can call about that. We have a toll-free number. You can also call if you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to express that. The number to use in either case is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And our first caller today is Mike, calling from Garden Grove, California. Mike, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. My question is, what is God's foreknowledge based upon? Like in 1 Peter 1:2, it says, "Elect according to foreknowledge of God the Father." I know God knows everything. At least I believe that. He doesn't learn anything. I'm not Calvinistic in any way, shape, or form. And Arminians usually teach, they say, well, it's based on God knowing how a person will respond. But I don't see how that ties in or goes with when God chose the Jewish people for thousands of years now. They've basically been in unbelief. So I'm just kind of confused. I what is God's foreknowledge based upon?
You mean how does God know the future?
No, He's God. You know, God doesn't learn anything. He knows everything. I mean,
well, when you say what is it based upon, I'm not sure how you mean that.
Okay, the Bible teaches, or at least the way when I read it and the way I understand it, like in Romans chapter 8, it says, "For whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate, and then he predestinated, he called." It seems like the individuals are, before we're born, according to Romans 8, God foreknows us before we're born and we're chosen. It's based on his foreknowledge.
Uh-huh.
So, how does that exactly work? I mean, if it's...
Well, that's a good question, but I'm not sure we are given enough information to know the answer. How does it work that God knows our future?
No, he's God. He knows everything. He doesn't learn anything.
It sounds like, I'm not sure really how to put what you're asking into a question. You're asking basically, are you asking if how his foreknowledge works with his predestination? Is that what you're asking?
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's how I should...
I first of all, I don't know how God knows the future. Okay, that's the first thing. I don't know if he exists outside of time, as many people say. For example, C.S. Lewis taught that God lives in a realm outside of time, in eternity, and therefore he can see the past, present, and future in one glimpse.
Right.
And I think this is a fairly common view among Christians. Or if God knows the future because he simply can project out from the present trajectory of things, that doesn't seem to work as a theory so well, because, of course, free will seems like it could throw a wrench in the works. The Bible really doesn't tell us how God knows. Now, some Calvinists say, the reason God knows is because he's preordained everything that's going to happen. So since
right.
he can make it all happen, of course he knows what he's going to do. It may be that the truth is a combination of different things. But the point is that God does claim to know what's going to happen. And Peter says in 1 Peter 1:2 that we are elect or chosen according to the foreknowledge of God. I don't know what according to the foreknowledge of God means. It sounds almost like it's saying because of what he foreknew. He made certain choices.
Right.
Likewise, when Paul uses that term in Romans 8:29, where he says, "Whom he did foreknow, he also did predestined to be conformed to the image of his son." Sounds like it's saying that God had knowledge of certain people before they were born.
Exactly.
Knew what they would do.
Yeah.
And made certain determinations about them based upon that. That's at least how I think most Arminians understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, it's never really explained because the foreknowledge of God is more often demonstrated than discussed in the Bible. It's demonstrated by the prophecies that he gives about the future. And the Old Testament, for example, is full of those kinds of prophecies. And the New Testament has some too. And so we can see God's foreknowledge exhibited. But we don't have a lot of passages where his foreknowledge is discussed as a topic. And certainly nothing in the Bible that explains to us his foreknowledge. What we can say is that God made his predeterminations about history and about salvation and so forth based on his knowledge of what the future holds, whether it's the future of what he intended to do himself or what he could foresee others doing. This is never really explained to us. I think people who come up with answers to that would do so based on whatever their theology is in other areas. In other words, if a person's Calvinistic, they'd be more inclined to say it's based on his sovereign decrees.
Exactly.
He knows what's going to happen. And whereas from the Arminian point of view, it's more likely that he said, well, he knows what people are going to do somehow. He just knows and bases his choices on that. But to tell you the truth, the Bible just doesn't answer that. And perhaps we have to live without an answer until we meet God and find out exactly how that all works.
That's probably the best answer. I'm trying to get it all categorized in my mind, and it's probably that the Bible doesn't really give us the answer on this particular question.
I think not. And you know what? There's certainly nothing wrong with trying to sort these things out, because if the Bible does give us enough information to sort them out, then it's a worthy exercise of our mental energy, and it's a good focus. Theological exploration is a very positive way to use your mind. But sometimes the best we can do is admit that there isn't enough information given to us to answer some of the philosophical types of questions we have.
Right. Okay, thank you, Steve. God bless you.
Okay, Mike. God bless you, too. Thanks for calling. I wish I could have helped you better. Let's talk to, let's see, who's been here longest? It looks like Wynn from Palos Verdes, California, has been waiting longest. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question today has to do with Ezra chapter 1. It talked about in order to fulfill the prophet Jeremiah's prophecy that God is stirring up King Cyrus, I believe, to allow Jews to go back. Now, the prophecy for Jeremiah, is this something about like a Jeremiah prophesied that they will be in captivity for 70 years? And if the 70 years is literally exactly 70 years, or is it just an approximation? And if it's exact, from what day to what date? Do you know?
Right. It depends on where you start the and end it. It can be seen to be 70 years just about exactly. And I've heard of three different ways it's calculated. One of the ways is to take it from the first set of captives that were taken by Nebuchadnezzar in 605 B.C. and to the time when the Jews laid the foundation of the temple in 516, I think it's 516, am I right there? Or 538. I mean, they came back in 538 B.C., which is almost exactly 70 years from 605 B.C. But from the time the temple was destroyed in 586 until the foundation of the new temple was laid, I think was just about exactly 70 years. There's a number of ways it's actually been calculated. And, it seems like there's several ways in which it's true. But it's pretty close. Even if you didn't have an exact 70 years, there's certainly nothing wrong with a 68 or 69 year period being rounded off to 70. But I believe that if depending on where you start it, because there were three exiles, this is the problem. the captivity, did it start in 605? Or did it start in 597 B.C. when Jehoiakim was taken into captivity? Or did it start in 586 B.C. when Jerusalem was burned down and the rest of the Jews were carried away? It seems like an argument can be made for each of those dates, being used as the starting point. But to make it 70 years, you pretty much have to have it from 605 B.C. to about... to about 535 B.C., something like that. And that's they did return in 538 B.C. So that's right around the time of the 70th year. And then they laid the foundation of the temple. I think they laid the foundation in 536 B.C., I believe. So it's right around this exact 70 years.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Wynn. God bless you. Jean from Anaheim is next. And we have one line open if you'd like to give us a call. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. And Jean, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate your show.
Yeah.
Hey, quick question. Actually, two-part. I'm going to try to be quick, but when it comes to hell, I know I called in before. You talked about how, the Old Testament has a lot of, typography, pictures of it's hard to kind of grasp it. But if we look at just simply the New Testament, even Jesus, the way he talks about hell, I just want to get your take on some of the things that he says.
Okay. Any in particular?
For example, how he talks about it would be better if you didn't have your arm if it caused you to stumble, your eye to be thrown into fiery hell. So I'm just curious on your thoughts.
Yeah, that's Mark 9. Well, the word hell there is Gehenna. Different words that Jesus in the New Testament is recorded in the Greek. There's two Greek words that are used for hell there. One is Hades, and the other is Gehenna. Now, of course, Hades is not what we're thinking of as the eternal place of the damned. Hades is where people go as soon as they die, whereas the place of the damned that we would normally think of where the lost go after the judgment would be at the end of the world when Jesus has come back and judged the sheep and the goats, and he sends off the goats into, everlasting punishment and everlasting fire.
Right.
So there's... Hades is one thing and Gehenna is another. Now Gehenna is almost universally translated as hell, but it's not clear why it should be. The word Gehenna actually has a meaning in the Greek. It's the meaning is the Valley of Hinnom. Gehenna is simply the Greek word for the Valley of Hinnom, which was actually a geographical site just southwest of Jerusalem, where and actually you can still go there today. I've walked in Gehenna myself. A few years ago. And that place was a place where dead bodies were cast in great numbers at the time when the Babylonians overthrew Jerusalem. And Jeremiah, the prophet, twice made predictions that the Valley of Hinnom will be called the Valley of Slaughter because of the abundance of the corpses that would be thrown into it because of the Babylonians coming and destroying Jerusalem. Now, because of Jeremiah's use of the term that way, there's a good likelihood that Jesus used the term that way too, that he wasn't talking about hell, and that translating Gehenna as hell is really not a good translation. It's more of an interpretation given by translators, because the word itself means the Valley of Hinnom. So if Jesus said it's better for you to have your arm chopped off than to keep your arm and be thrown into the Valley of Hinnom, if he's speaking in the same terms Jeremiah did when he spoke of the Valley of Hinnom, and I think there's a good chance he was, then he's talking about the same kind of thing Jeremiah was talking about. Namely, in Jeremiah's day, because of the sins of Israel, judgment was coming. The Babylonians were coming. They're going to destroy Jerusalem, burn down the temple, slaughter the Jews, and throw them into the Valley of Hinnom, their corpses. And Jesus was talking to Israel at a time when they were in danger of the same thing happening. The Romans were soon going to come and burn down the temple and destroy Jerusalem and slaughter the Jews and cast their bodies into the Valley of Hinnom. And therefore, to say it's better to have this other thing happen to you than to be thrown into the Valley of Hinnom might not be a reference to hell, per se, but rather to the same thing Jeremiah was talking about, that you're coming under the judgment of God as a nation. The nation of Israel was coming under God's judgment, and Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and the invaders were going to fill the Valley of Hinnom with the corpses. And, you know, a lot of times what Jesus said about the coming judgment of AD 70 has been, because I guess because Christians are not that much in tune with what happened in AD 70 or its significance biblically, we sometimes just assume he's talking about some general judgment of all people or something like that. And so Gehenna traditionally has been translated as hell, and it's been interpreted as a post-mortem judgment of all the lost. Well, I do believe in hell. I do believe there's a post-mortem judgment. I believe the lost are going to go into the fire of judgment. But that's a different issue than whether Jesus is talking about that when he uses the term Gehenna. Now, most scholars support the idea that Gehenna means hell when Jesus used it, because the rabbis, even prior to Jesus' time, the rabbis had adopted the innovation of using the word Gehenna to refer to hell. So we've got two things going on when Jesus came and used the word Gehenna. We've got the fact that the rabbis had already begun to use that term to mean hell. And that is the justification for English translators to translate Gehenna as hell, because that's how the rabbis used the term. But then Jeremiah, long earlier than the rabbis, Jeremiah had used the word Gehenna to speak of the place where the corpses would be thrown when Jerusalem was to be destroyed by invaders. And so the question we have to ask ourselves, was Jesus using Gehenna the way the rabbis did or the way the prophets did? Now, I believe that Jesus had a much closer affinity to the prophets of the Old Testament than he had to the rabbis of his day. In fact, the rabbis are the people who were the scribes and Pharisees. And Jesus warned his disciples, beware of the doctrine of the scribes and Pharisees. It would be a strange thing if Jesus simply adopted an idea that the scribes and Pharisees had come up with on their own without inspiration, and had identified Gehenna the way they did with hell. And yet that's what almost all translators assume that Jesus did. I think it's more likely Jesus used the term the way Jeremiah did, in which case that's his statements about Gehenna shouldn't be translated hell at all. They should be translated instead of interpreted. The word Gehenna should be translated Valley of Hinnom. But if translators translated it that way, most American readers, most English readers, would not know what he's talking about. But maybe that's too bad, because we might miss what he's saying. Mm. So I believe that he may be saying, when he talks about Gehenna, that it's better to suffer harm for the cause of righteousness. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Better to overcome sin, better to be on God's side than to be treated with God's enemies in the having your corpse cast in the Valley of Hinnom. That is, you die under the judgment of God that was coming upon apostate Israel. Remember, Jesus was talking to Jews. We who are not Jews can read his words today, but we have to remember who he was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And he told them. He told them in Luke chapter 19 that their enemies were going to come and besiege their city and cast their walls down and their children within them down to the ground. Not one stone would be left standing on another. At another place in Matthew 24, Jesus said that the temple is going to be destroyed in that way, and not one stone would be left standing on another. And he often said this is going to happen in this generation, which it did. He spoke about his generation about five or six different times. And a lot of what Jesus had to say was applicable to his generation primarily. Now, if someone says, well, if it doesn't apply to us, what's the use of it to us? Well, what's the use of reading the book of Isaiah to us?
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah talks about the destruction of Jerusalem and Israel and Babylon and things. I mean, what's the point? You know, what good is that to us? Well, what it shows us is that God has judged societies that sin because he hates sin. And that we'd better avoid sin, or else we will not avoid judgment. It's just that the judgment we will face may not be to be literally having our corpse thrown in the Valley of Hinnom like they did.
Mm.
And there is a post-mortem judgment and penalty. So, in other words, when I say I have my doubts that Jesus was talking about hell when he used the word Gehenna. That doesn't mean that I have doubts that there's a hell. I just think that we need to be careful not to read hell into passages where it may not have been intended. And that's, I think, probably the case when the word Gehenna was used. I'm definitely in the very minority in thinking that. But again, it's based on the fact that we have to have Jesus using the Valley of Hinnom either the way the rabbis did or the way the prophets did.
Mm.
The prophets used it as an emblem of the destruction of Jerusalem and the slaughter of the people who died in that judgment. The rabbis used it of a post-mortem hell. But I don't know of any other case where Jesus, you know, wished to affirm the speculations of the rabbis. And that's exactly what it would be if the rabbis said, well, when people die, they go into this Gehenna after death. Well, how would they know that if they didn't have any inspiration? The rabbis were just guessing. And I just don't think it was any part of Jesus' intention to confirm the speculations of the rabbis. He seemed to be at odds with them more often than not.
It's refreshing to hear a different perspective on that. I really appreciate your answer.
All right. Well, I could be wrong, but it's something to think about.
Yes, no doubt about it. Thank you so much.
All right, Gene. God bless you. I appreciate your call, brother. Let's talk to Gifford from Rancho Cucamonga next. Gifford, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Hello. Thanks for taking my call. See, I have a question about Luke, the 12th chapter. Excuse me. Luke, the 12th chapter, where Jesus is giving the parable about the wise steward and the unwise, about the wise steward. And in verse 47 and 48, he says, "And that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know, yet committed things worthy of stripes, shall be beaten with few. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed of him, they will ask the more." Can you explain the differences in punishment, it seems like, for these two servants?
Yeah, it's a good question. This is one of the passages, and there are not very many, but there are a few passages that seem to indicate that in the judgment there will be grades or degrees of judgment. In this case, Jesus suggests the degrees will be based upon how much the person knew. That is, if people do things worthy of stripes, and by stripes he means flogging, he's using an imagery from the discipline of somebody who was sentenced to be flogged.
Right.
if they knew they were doing the wrong thing, their flogging will be more severe than
right.
if they didn't know they were doing the wrong thing. That's what he says. So it's a little bit like what he said about when he's saying to Capernaum, where he had done most of his miracles. He said, you know, in the day of judgment, it'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than for you. Because if these miracles had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented. So he's saying Sodom and Gomorrah didn't have as much knowledge as you have, didn't have as many advantages as Capernaum had. And therefore, although Sodom and Gomorrah is lost, yet in the day of judgment, their judgment will be more tolerable than that for Capernaum, which had more advantage. More opportunity and squandered. It's interesting that, you know, Jesus is saying there will be degrees of punishment. And one of the things that will mitigate punishment, although apparently not eliminate it, is that people sinned ignorantly rather than knowing what they were doing. Now, I'm assuming that this has to do with the judgment post-mortem. There are possibilities that Jesus is giving a principle about God's chastening in a person's life in this life, and simply that he'll chasten people more severely if they knowingly rebel than if they don't. But I think most people, most commentators would agree, this probably has to do with post-mortem, after Jesus comes back and each one is judged according to his works, the Bible says. Well, then each will receive the reward of the things he's done in the body, and this would be one of the principles that would guide that sentencing. You know, how much did they know? Now, if indeed this is so, then it suggests that when people go to hell, they won't all experience exactly the same punishment there. Some people think the punishment of some will be longer than others. Of course, this would be if one does not argue for eternal hell. If those who argue for annihilationism, or even for restorationism or universal reconciliation, Those who think that hell, you know, ends up having some result like that would say this is talking about some will have a longer period of judgment in hell. Now, those who believe that hell is eternal would have to say, well, of course, everyone has the same length of time in hell because eternity is the same length for everybody, but the intensity would be different for some. And so there's different ways people have wrestled with this passage. One thing is clear, that all three of the views of hell, and I've been studying them intensively lately from the authors who hold to each of them, all of them make a point of this degrees of punishment idea. And each of them thinks it works best for their view. So those who believe in eternal torment believe that the degree of punishment will be in terms of intensity, not duration, since all people's hell will be equally long. But those who hold the other views believe that maybe not so equally long for everybody.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's a good explanation for me. The related question would be, is that specifically for unbelievers, or are believers, particularly rebellious believers or believers who insist on living in sin because of their belief in hyper-grace, would they be facing such judgments at the post-mortem judgment?
Or is it all possibly. Very possibly, because this passage has a parallel in Matthew chapter 23. And it says that the servant who is described here will be, when his master comes, will be cut in two and given his portion with the hypocrites. In other words, although he's one of the servants, because of his presumption, he ends up having the same judgment as those who were only hypocrites, who were not true servants at all. I wish I could explore this more with you now, but I'm going to be cut off in 30 seconds, so I only have time to say a few things. But thank you, Gifford, for your call, and all who've called today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a radio think tank each weekday morning, and we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again Monday. Have a good weekend.
You need to be encouraged now and then, and the people behind this ministry are no different. That's why we're doing something we call Project Encouragement. We've made it easy for you to record a short word of encouragement for this ministry that we'll send to them. This isn't about donations or mailing lists. It's just a way for you to turn 2 minutes of your time into a blessing for a ministry you appreciate. Just call 800-227-2337, extension 311, and follow the prompts. Please call now while you're thinking about it. 800-227-2337, extension 311.
Project Encouragement is all about encouraging the ministries on KBright. And if you could take the time to encourage the ministry of Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path, that would be terrific, and it will go such a long way towards blessing him. So if you would like to be able to participate in our Project Encouragement, please call 800-227-2337, go to extension 311, and just follow the prompts from there. If you need more information, you can go to KBRT740.com. Up next, it's Joyce Meyer on AM 740 KBright.
For the first time in 32 years of ministry, Pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church is bringing his uplifting yet practical teaching to radio. Starting April 1st, we're partnering with Rick Warren to launch his new radio ministry, Daily Hope, heard exclusively here at 1:30 and then again at 6 every weekday. Hundreds of thousands of people receive Rick's devotional, Daily Hope, and now millions more can be blessed as Daily Hope launches its international outreach April 1st right here on AM 740 KBright, strengthening the local body of Christ.
Southern California's only 50,000-watt Christian station, KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Let God Fight Your Battles. In life, there are many battles that we will encounter. Some deal with our friends and family, others deal with health issues, and some with financial difficulties. But no matter how big the battle may seem, it's encouraging to know that Christ has given us power to win them.
In today's teaching, Joy shares how you can secure real victory in life with a genuine relationship with God. Everything you'll hear today can be found in Joyce's four-part CD teaching, Let God Fight Your Battles. When you order today's offer, you'll also receive her book, The Battle Belongs to the Lord. Just visit joycemeyer.org and get your copy today. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching entitled, Let God Fight Your Battles.
Psalm 31:20. In the secret place of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You keep them secretly in your pavilion from the strife of tongues. That means when you hide yourself in God, even the things that people say about you can't have any real effect on you. God will protect you from those evil, wicked words that are being spoken. No weapon formed against me shall prosper. Every tongue that rises up against me in judgment, I will show to be in the wrong. Come on, give God a big shout. Okay, now listen for a few minutes. Why are some people closer to God than others? It's obvious that some people are closer to God than others. They have a reverent familiarity. They actually talk about God like they know Him. Like they've got some personal thing going on.